the activities of Lord Rishabhdev. So Lord Rishabhdev was an incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. The reason behind Lord Rishabhdev's appearance is Rishabhdev's father, King Nahi, performed a sacrifice, a great sacrifice. And the purpose of his sacrifice was to get a son like the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And when the sacrifice was completed, the fire sacrifice, when it was successfully completed, then the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan, appeared from the sacrificial fire. And their vision purified by austerity, people could see the Supreme Lord face to face. And at that time, it was presented to the Lord. Do you have a thing?
Sorry.
Thank you. Oh. So, it was the Purohits, the priests of the sacrifice, requested the Lord. The purpose of the sacrifice was that the king could get a son like himself. And so at that time, the Supreme Lord told them that there is no one who is like me, only I am like me. Because the Supreme Personality of Godhead is one without a second. So he said that you'll never find, there's no one who's like me, so since you want a son like me, then I myself have to come and take birth. And he did. The Lord appeared as the son of King Nadi, and that was Rishabhdev. Rishabhdev was a very noble king, and those days, the kings were not only the kings of a small tract of land. And these kings, like Rishabhdev, King Bharat, all the way up to King Parikshit, Maharaj Parikshit, they were the rulers of the entire earth planet. Actually, that is the normal arrangement of Krishna, that different planets are actually ruled by one person. For example, we know that the sun planet has a ruler, somebody who is the predominating controller of the sun planet. Who is that? Sun God. Similarly, moon planet is controlled by Chandradeva, Somdeva. Different planets like Jupiter, Mars, and Venus, they all are actually controlled by different personalities. And one person is the ruler. And this is a normal structure actually. I mean, this is how it must be. Like we have a line of authority, and there somebody must be. There must be one person who is on top. And it goes all the way up to Krishna. Krishna is the supreme leader, the supreme boss, the supreme king. But otherwise, we have state by state, we find that there's one person, then above him there's another person, and if it goes higher and higher. So, this first planet was controlled by one king. And those kings used to rule the kingdom, or rule the planet, as a representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And what was the objective? What was the main purpose? The main purpose was to educate people to become devoted of Krishna. And that is the business of a king. So, Rishabhdev in this way ruled over the kingdom for many, many years. And then he decided to leave. When he when he left his, just before leaving his body, King Vishvadev actually advised his children. Vishvadev had 100 sons. Out of them, the eldest was King Bharat. And he enthroned him, he coronated him in the throne and made him the ruler of the earth planet. And he instructed, Vishvadev instructed all his other sons to follow King Bharat, the elder brother. And we notice that after the first, next 9 sons became also rulers of different parts of, like Bharat was the ruler of the earth planet, and then the earth planet has 9 islands. Varshas. So these 9 different sons became the rulers of those 9 Varshas. And then next 9 sons became Sannyasis. Although they were king sons, they were princes, but they decided to give up their palace, give up their royal comfort. And they accepted the life of a devotee. And they are known as Navajogendra. In the 11th canto, we find the description of Navajogendra. There are 9 great saintly persons, very, very elevated saintly personalities. Their name is their names are, let me say, Pikmalayan, Kobi, Hobi, Abhihotra, Karabhajan. So you can just read from here. Okay, let's read from here. The characteristics of Rishabhdev, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In this chapter, Rishabhdev, the son of Maharaj Nabhi, begot 100 sons. And during the reign of those sons, the world was very happy in all respects. When Rishabhdev appeared as the son of Maharaj Nabhi, he was appreciated by the people as the most exalted and beautiful personality of that age. His poise, influence, strength, enthusiasm, bodily luster, and other transcendental qualities were beyond compare. The word Rishabha means the best or the supreme. Due to the super excellent attributes of the son of Maharaj Nabhi, the king named him Rishabha, or the best. His influence was incomparable. Although there was a scarcity of rain, Rishabhdev did not care for Indra, the king of heaven who is in charge of supplying rain. Through his own potency, Rishabhdev sumptuously covered Ajanabha Varsha with ample rain. Upon receiving Rishabhdev, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as his son, King Nabhi began to raise him very carefully. After that, he entrusted the ruling power to him, and retiring from family life, lived at Badrikashram, completely engaged in the worship of Vasudev, the Supreme Lord. To follow social customs, Lord Rishabhdev for a while became a student in the Gurukul, and after returning, he followed the orders of his Guru and accepted wife named Jayanti, who had been given to him by the king of heaven, Indra. He begot 100 sons in the womb of Jayanti. Of these 100 sons, the eldest was known as Bharat. Since the reign of Maharaj Bharat, this planet has been known as Bharatvarsha. Actually, the original name of this planet is Bharatvarsha, named after King Bharat. Rishabhdev's other sons were headed by Kushabrata, Hilavarta, Brahmavarta, Malaya, Ketu, Bhadrasena, Indraprich, Bidarbha and Kitaka. There were also other sons named Kobi, Havi, Antariksha, Prabuddha, Pipalayan, Abhihotra, Dhrumila, Chamasha and Karabhajana. So these nine sons became the sages and they were known as Navajogendras. Navajogendra means, Nava means nine. Yoga means mystic practice. And Indra means the best. So Navajogendra means the nine best accomplished, most accomplished persons in the art of yoga. So their names are Kobi, Havi, Antariksha, Prabuddha, Pipalayan, Abhihotra, Dhrumila, Chamasha and Karabhajan. Instead of ruling the kingdom, these nine became mendicant preachers of Krishna consciousness, following the religious precepts of the Bhagavata. Their characteristics and activities are described in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. During the talks between Vasudev and Narad at Kurukshetra, to teach the general populace, King Rishabhdev performed many sacrifices and taught his sons how to rule the citizens. So then Lord Rishabhdev decided to leave his household status as a grihastha. He has decided to retire and he accepted vanaprastha or then gradually laid into sannyas. And this also is a very wonderful example. Like, although a king, he gave up his kingdom. When his sons grew up, he just assigned the responsibility to his children and he just walked out of his family life. And he used to actually behave like a madman. So we can also consider, read that. This is very important, Lord Rishabhdev's teachings to his sons. In this chapter, there is a description of Bhagavat Dharma, religious principles and devotional service that transcend religious principles for liberation and the mitigation of material misery. It is stated in this chapter that a human being should not work hard like dogs and hogs for sense gratification. Like, the first thing he told his children, that this human form of life is not meant to be to work hard like cats and dogs, or dogs and hogs, for sense gratification. As Prabhupada used to say, work like a dog to enjoy like a hog. And that's what today's civilization is. People are working so hard for what? Just to enjoy like a hog, enjoy like a pig. And what is the pig's standard of enjoyment? Eat the worst kind of stuff in this world. The pigs are very fond of eating stew. That is their delicacy. And all they want is sex life. Human life is specially meant for the revival of our relationship with the Supreme Lord, and to this end, all kinds of austerities and penances should be accepted. To fulfill the mission of human life, in order to develop our lost relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Not lost, our forgotten relationship. We have forgotten. But Krishna did not fight. The relationship is still there, but we are oblivious of it. Give him a tap. Get up. So it's the living entities, the conditioned souls have forgotten Krishna. Krishna did not forget us. So that if on our part, we simply have to remember Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, our relationship with Him. And the human life provides us with the facility. Actually, when a living entity forgets Krishna, then he plunges into an ocean of ignorance. This material nature is an ocean of ignorance. Actually, ignorance is a substance. Just as water is a substance and there is an ocean of water. So similarly, ignorance is a substance. And we are plunged in the ocean of ignorance. And what happens when you are plunged in an ocean of ignorance? When you are plunged in the ocean of water, then what happens? You become covered over by water. You become surrounded by it. You drown in the water. You sink in the water. So when you are plunged in the ocean of ignorance, then we sink in ignorance. And ignorance means what? Loss of knowledge. So we forgot. That's how we lost our knowledge of Krishna, awareness of Krishna. But when one gets a human form of life, when one gets a human body, then he gets a special facility to remember Krishna. Or he gets a special facility to come out of ignorance. And the way to come out of ignorance is Krishna consciousness. So when one gets a human form of life, he must somehow or other try to become Krishna conscious. In other ages, that facility, that opportunity was not there. But now it has become available by Srila Prabhupada's mercy. In other ages, even 25 years ago, 28, 29 years ago, what kind of facility people had in the world, outside of India to become Krishna conscious? Was there any facility? Revati? There was no facility. Like, there were so many sadhus and yogis going to America, but they were just a bunch of cheaters. Bhagavan such and such. But then Bhagavan died out of a heart attack. First he was humiliated for all kinds of nonsensical activities, he was convicted. So this is the ultimate destiny of this so-called Bhagavan. So many people from India actually went just to cheat people in the West. And America at that time was so gullible. Like anyone who came with long hair was considered to be a great saint in America. And if anyone from India came with a long hair and saffron robe, people thought that he must be an incarnation of God. And people were so easily deceived. Then different yogis came and gave all kinds of promises simply to get money out of people. But only when Prabhupada went to America, the real spiritual process became available to the people in the West. Not before Srila Prabhupada went. Now, what to speak of the West, even in India people did not have access to spiritual life. Like, even in India people were misled. Like, they used to think that all kinds of cheaters are actually That misconception was there even in India. At one time in India I was searching, looking for a guru before I met Srila Prabhupada, and I had a pretty nice exposure to these cheetahs. Basically those who were leading the life of a sadhu, they're kind of innocent. They are not such cheetahs, they're just happy smoking ganja, hashish and marijuana. And they perform certain carefree life, they lead a kind of a carefree life. And Indian atmosphere is very conducive also. Indian atmosphere is so nice that you don't need clothes. But there are mosquitoes. But you smear ash in your body and then the mosquitoes won't bite you. So that's why the sadhus, they smear ash in their body. And it also keeps the cold. I mean, if it's cold, it keeps the body warm. Actually, what ash does is covers up all the pores of the body. And then when one smokes, he loses his external consciousness and plunges into ignorance. And for food there is no scarcity actually. You go to any place of pilgrimage, any holy place in India, you find there are so many people there. They made arrangements for free food distribution. For example, if in Haridwar, Rishikesh, many people have made arrangements for free food distribution. Rich people, they have their arrangements. And you go there and you get food. And otherwise you get prasad from the temple. There are places where there are big temples. Like for example, in Tirupati, for 1 rupee, 1 rupee means 10 cents, 10 centimes. For 10 centimes, you get the most delicious prasad. And you can eat as much as you want. So this, and for sadhus it's free. If you have long hair and long beard or shaved head, whatever, wearing saffron, you just go. For sadhu, no charge. So for that matter, India is actually very conducive for practicing spiritual life. Indian atmosphere, very, very conducive. So people don't actually have to worry. Those who want to take to spiritual life, they don't have to worry about anything. At least for their eating and sleeping, enough arrangements are there. At one time in 1979, I was traveling, I was walking on foot in North India with a few devotees. 5 or 6 boys were with me. And we saw how easy it is to lead for the sadhus. Like, we would stop, generally, we would stop in, say, when we would go to a place, and every temple, every village has a temple. So we would just, after walking from one village, 10, 12 kilometers to another village, we would stop, and we'll find a temple, and we'll just stop there, we'll sit there. And practically in no time, the word would get around. There, and people would come. People would come immediately to see us. And then they would inquire what arrangements we'd like for our prasadam. And they would bring vegetables, rice, everything, all the ingredients. And we would cook prasad. And they would help, the village people, they would cut the vegetables, arrange them, wash the rice and get everything. And then we would cook, and after offering to
to Srila Prabhupada's picture, Radha Krishna's picture, because we didn't have deities.
Will you take prasadam?
Just eat the prasadam. They would accept it, so with so much respect.
And then in the evening, practically the whole village would come and sit around us, and we would give a class.
And
in a way, it's very exciting. And I'm sure in any part of India that actually applies, although I was traveling only in North India, but South India is even more pious. North India lost its spiritual culture to a great extent because of the heavy Muslim influence. But South India was kept intact from that influence. So in South India it's even better. But of course in South India we have a problem that people don't actually speak. But in some village, I don't know. But one thing in South India again, that people there speak English more than North India. In South India every common man practically speaks English. Anyway, the point is that to lead spiritual, but one thing in South India again, that people there speak English more than North India. In South India every common man practically speaks English. Anyway, the point is that to lead spiritual life in India is very, very easy. It's not at all difficult. But the problem actually is to find a bona fide spiritual master. Like, I was actually seeing how practically no one had the real knowledge. Of course, I also didn't know what I was looking for. But when I met with those people and I spoke to them, I felt that those people, they don't know. And then when I came in contact with Srila Prabhupada through his books, The Nectar of Devotion, from the very first page I felt, yeah, this is what I was looking for. So even in India, real spiritual life was not available to people until Srila Prabhupada came. Or until Srila Prabhupada started to preach. And how did Srila Prabhupada preach? When Prabhupada was preaching in India, no one took him seriously. At first Prabhupada tried to preach in India before going to America. No one actually responded. There was only one person who responded and became a disciple of Srila Prabhupada. He was a big Sanskrit scholar. I didn't meet him, but Prabhupada often spoke about him. He was a great Sanskrit scholar. That was the only person that actually responded to Srila Prabhupada's call. But then what Prabhupada had to do? Prabhupada had to go to America to start the movement. And then he came back to India with his Western disciples, his dancing white elephants. And that's how he started to preach. In India, people did not actually come being so much interested about Srila Prabhupada. They actually came being interested by the Western devotees. That was a big excitement for them. What are these Americans doing? Shaved up, wearing saffron robes, and they're following the Swami. And they were not so interested about Swami so much. They were interested, they were just curious, not even curious, they're just fun seekers, looking for some fun. And what was the impression of the Western devotees those days? Oh, these must be a bunch of CIAs. They must have come with some motivation. They must be American spies. I remember when I joined in 1976, so many people used to think that ISKCON devotees were CIAs. And it was very humiliating. People would
I used to travel to Calcutta from Mayapur quite often to the construction. I used to buy the material for the Mayapur, and there was and we used to travel mostly by buses, and people would pass all kinds of remarks, calling us CIS, this, that. And sometimes we used to have big arguments, right in the middle of a train or in the middle of a bus. And then gradually, people started to accept. Now, the acceptance is quite well, quite good. All over India, practically, people have recognized that these devotees are genuine. And with the passing of time, they will become more and more aware of that fact, that these devotees are genuine people. So, this human form of life is specially meant for revival of our relationship with the Supreme Lord. And to this end, all kinds of austerities and penances should be accepted. By austere activities, one's heart can be cleansed of material contamination. And as a result, one can be situated on a spiritual platform. To attain this perfection, one has to take shelter of a devotee and serve him. Then the door of liberation will be open. Those who are materially attached to women and sense gratification gradually become entangled in material consciousness and suffer the miseries of birth, old age, disease and death. So this is how Rishabdev is instructing his children. And what to do and what not to do. Now he is still telling us, you got this human form of life, just utilize this opportunity for your spiritual advancement. And the way to make spiritual advancement is to take shelter of a bona fide spiritual master and serve him, serve under his direction. Follow his path, follow his instructions, serve under his direction, then the door of liberation will be open. It's very important that a spiritual master is a devotee. Often people look for a spiritual master who is a yogi or who is a jnani. Now, apparently they may appear to be very impressive. Sometimes these yogis can perform miracles and people become very impressed. We find actually so many people are following this yogi. Why? Because they can perform certain miracles. And most cases they don't, these miracles they perform is not really white stuff, it's black stuff, black magic. But people are naturally foolish and they get impressed, they get enamored by them. Only a devotee can lead properly. And what does his leading, where does he lead to? He leads to the spiritual sky. And that's why Rishabdev is saying, then the door of liberation becomes wide open. Whereas those who are materially entangled, materially attached, material attachment is attachment to women, attachment to sense gratification. That leads to tamadvaram, that leads to hell. Those who are attached to the senses, they go down to the hellish condition. We can expect it's common sense, like we have two aspects of our existence in the material. We have a material aspect of existence, we have a spiritual aspect of existence. The material aspect of existence is senses, the body, right? The material existence is the bodily existence. The existence pertaining to the body. And the body means senses. So if we become carried away, or if we become too attached to our sense enjoyments, if we lead a life that is centered around sense enjoyments, which way we will go? We will go towards matter. Matter means opposite to the spirit. And that is the meaning of going down. And if we take to the spiritual side of our existence, then at the beginning it is opposite to the matter. So that means negation of matter. It's not that we literally negate matter, but the negation becomes automatic. When we become situated on our spiritual pursuit, then the opposite thing automatically becomes rejected. An example can be given, like there is light and there is darkness. So as soon as the light comes up, what happens to darkness? Darkness automatically disappears. Light and darkness cannot exist simultaneously. So similarly, material and spiritual are diametrically opposite. So whenever there is light, darkness is there. Whenever there is spiritual awareness, material attachment automatically becomes reduced and ultimately it becomes nil. So material attachment and spiritual advancement cannot go on simultaneously. Like spiritual advancement will immediately or automatically cause a cessation of material attachments. And that cessation of material attachment is actually called austerity. And that's what Rishabhdev is suggesting. But austerity can be of two types. As I was explaining yesterday afternoon, there are two types of austerities. One is a forced austerity and the other is a spontaneous austerity. The forced austerity is like when you say that, no, we must not do this, we must not do that. My senses are running that direction, I must control my senses. That is a force, but the forced austerity is a negative and it makes one's heart harder. The yogis do that. They go to a solitary place and they perform all kinds of austerities to control their senses. But it doesn't last. It's not positive. But there is another kind of austerity, which is a spontaneous austerity. For example, when one develops one's love for Krishna, then one automatically gives up material attachments. So that is what one actually should aspire for. And Krishna consciousness leads to this natural austerity. In the beginning there may be some force, some pressure, compulsion. But that is just to situate oneself properly in the path of Krishna consciousness. But as one makes spiritual advancement, these austerities become spontaneous and natural. And that is the meaning of, these are the stages of Vaidhi Bhakti, Sadhana Bhakti and Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti and Radhanuga Bhakti. Radhanuga means spontaneous. It automatically happens. Like an example can be given in this way, that some woman may be very fond of sleeping. Like in material nature, everyone loves to sleep. But when she becomes a mother, then she stays up the whole night practically, caring for the child. Now staying up is a great austerity, staying up at night. Isn't it? Some of us even fall asleep in Bhagavatam class, what to speak of staying up at night. So it is an austerity to stay up at night. But the mother naturally undergoes that austerity. Why? because of her love for her child.
So similarly, Krishna consciousness is a process of voluntarily accepting so-called austerities for the sake of our love for Krishna. So that austerity is the positive austerity, which comes automatically. Those who are materially attached to women and sense gratification gradually become entangled in material consciousness and suffer the miseries of birth, old age, disease and death. Those who are engaged in the general welfare of all and who are not attached to children and family are called Mahatmas. Those who are engaged in sense gratification, who act piously or impiously, cannot understand the purpose of the soul. Therefore, they should approach a highly elevated devotee and accept him as a spiritual master. By his association, one will be able to understand the purpose of life. Under the instructions of such a spiritual master, one can attain devotional service to the Lord. Detachment from material things and tolerance of material misery and disease and distress. One can then see all living entities equally, and one becomes very eager to know about transcendental subject matters, endeavoring persistently for the satisfaction of Krishna. One becomes detached from wife, children and home. He is not interested in wasting time. In this way, one becomes self-realized. A person advanced in spiritual knowledge does not engage anyone in material activity. Want anyone to become entangled because he knows how binding these material activities are. These material activities are the cause of our bondage due to the karmic reaction. Once Prabhupada was explaining what karmic reaction is like. Prabhupada was taking prasad, and those days I used to cook for Srila Prabhupada, and I made some prune chutney, plum chutney. So Prabhupada, after eating that plum, Prabhupada took the seed, and he said that in this seed there is a tree. And in that tree, there are innumerable fruits. And in those fruits, there are innumerable seeds. And each seed has a tree in it. And that tree, those trees also have innumerable fruits. And this is Prabhupada went on and on. And he said that this is how inconceivable Krishna's creation is. That in the tiny little seed, there is a tree, and in that tree there are innumerable number of trees, seeds, and each seed has a tree. And then he said, and the karmic reaction also is just like this. One little karma can produce so many karma. Just one tiny little karmic reaction will set the chain reaction, and one will become eternally bound. So that's how heavy this karmic reaction is. So when one knows how incredibly binding these karmic reactions are, then why should one, when he knows, why should he engage others in that activity? And that's why devotees go out and tell people, please stop your nonsense. You do not know what you're doing to yourself. So please stop. It's a natural tendency of somebody who is situated in knowledge. Endeavoring persistently for the satisfaction of Krishna, one becomes detached from wife, children and home. He is not interested in wasting time. In this way, one becomes self-realized. A person advanced in spiritual knowledge does not engage anyone in material activity. And one who cannot deliver another person by instructing him in devotional service should not become a spiritual master, father, mother, demigod, or husband. This is also a very interesting, very important point. That unless one is able to deliver his subordinates or dependents from the bondage or from the cycle of birth and death, he should not become a spiritual master, father, mother, husband, demigod. Because these positions are actually the position of leadership. Position of leadership means they have the responsibility to lead their followers, their subordinates. And a person who is meant to lead, he must know where to lead to. And if he is not able to lead to that goal, then he should not take up that position. Then it will be very, very dangerous. So Rishabhadev is saying that not only a spiritual master should have the responsibility, but even father, mother, or husband, and demigod. Guru na shashat, shajano na shashat, janani na shashat, poti na shashat, namo charitya, samapeto mrittu. And doivam na shashat, namo charitya, samapeto mrittu. So, actually human beings, before producing children, should consider whether they are capable of delivering their children. Instructing his 100 sons, Lord Rishabhadev advised them to accept their eldest brother Bharat as their guide and lord, and thereby serve him. Of all living entities, the Brahmanas are the best. And above the Brahmanas, the Vaishnavas are situated in an even better position. So the position of a Vaishnava is even superior to a Brahmana. And who is a Vaishnava? Vaishnava means one who has become a servant of the Supreme Personality. Serving a Vaishnava means serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus, Sukadev Goswami describes the characteristics of Bharat Maharaj and the sacrificial performance executed by Lord Rishabhadev for the instruction of the general populace. I thought of covering Bharat Maharaj, but I... So, anyway, I'll stop now. Does anybody have any questions?
Question about the demigods. Beginning to talk about demigods, and I know in the 8th canto, the positions like Brahma, Shiva, are not, these are not Shivas, these are just positions.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, because it's also explained that Shiva has more qualities than Shiva.
Yeah.
So how can this be a position, the position of Shiva? The word is
so what was the answer?
There was no answer.
Yeah. From the scriptures we know that they are gunavatars, Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. They are gunavatars. And say for example, Lord Shiva's position is that he is Krishna himself, Narayan himself, who became transformed to perform some special business. And the special business too is to be in contact with external energy, Maya. You see, Narayan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead or Vishnu, and cannot directly deal with Maya. Right? Because Maya is his external energy. So if he directly deals with his, with this energy, then it will not be external anymore. It will become internal energy. You understand that point? Therefore, in order to deal with Maya, he assumes the position of Shiva. And Brahma Samhita, that's why he's saying, Shivam yatha dasi vikara visheshe yogat samjayate nahi tata vithavas vihet ja sambhutam api samupai tikajat govindam adipurusham tamahamaya. So, Shivam yatha dasi vikara visheshe yogat, just as milk is transformed into yogurt. And milk and yogurt are simultaneously same and again different. Right? It's yogurt. Yogurt that it's milk that has become yogurt. Right? But milk can become yogurt, but yogurt cannot become milk. Similarly, Vishnu, samupaiti karya, in order to perform some special function, he assumes the personality of Shiva. So that is the difference between Krishna and Shiva. Right? The Supreme, he is not Jiva. He is an incarnation. And Brahma is a, sometimes he can be a Jiva, sometimes he, Krishna himself can assume the position. Depending upon if there is a qualified devotee, qualified person, qualified jiva to take up the position. And we can see that their positions are very elevated. Like, what is Shiva's position? Shiva is the husband of Maya, Durga. So this entire material nature is controlled by the external potency of the Lord Maya. And Shiva is her control. And Brahma, he is the first personality who actually set the creation of this universe. Secondary creation. The primary creation was done by Krishna, Mahavishnu. But the secondary creation was done by Brahma. So these are two very, very special personalities. And they cannot be considered as just ordinary demigods. Demigods are jivas endowed with some very special responsibility. And that's why Shiva is called Deva Adideva. Deva Adideva. Deva means demigod. And Adideva means their god. So Shiva is the god of the demigod. And similarly, Brahma is also considered as the head of the demigods, the principal demigods. So that is how. Now, to give a practical example, say the proprietor of a company may appoint his brother in the company in some position. So when he appoints his brother in his company, he must give him a very, very special position, right? He may not become the proprietor of the company, but he has a very, very special position. And he cannot be seen as an employee, right? His identity is not as an employee, but his identity is that he is the brother of the proprietor of the company. In that light, you can see the position of Brahma and Shiva.
This part of the distinction between Brahma and Shiva, it sounds like it's possible for a Shiva to become Shiva.
No. A Jiva cannot become a Shiva. But Shiva is a position that can be attained by a Jiva. You see, Shiva, there is a position called Shivatta. Shivatta means the position of Shiva. And that position, that Shivatva means beyond material nature. You see, material nature is the place of anxiety. And beyond material nature is the complete, the state of total peacefulness. And this Shivatva is total peacefulness. So when one living entity goes out of this material nature, he comes to the region which is the region of total peacefulness. But that doesn't mean that he becomes Shiva. What question do you have? Last I heard he is there, but for some reason, when Prabhupada came back, he didn't really contact Srila Prabhupada. He may have contacted, but didn't really get involved in his talk. I don't know why. I never met him and I don't really know.
Knowledge
also is a substance, yeah. Just as light is a substance and darkness is a substance. Right? And not only, say for example, knowledge is not only a substance, knowledge is actually a personality. And this personality is energy, is knowledge. And this personality, Jnana, is the son of devotion. Knowledge is the son of devotion. And his brother, he has another brother, another son of devotion. You know what's his name? Renunciation.
Huh?
Yeah, right. Oh, you wanted to answer then? Yeah. Renunciation of Vairagya. Jnana and Vairagya. Do you have any questions?
How important is such a spirit in Vaishnava culture?
How important is
culture? The spirit in the
We must be aware that these austerities are conducive to Krishna consciousness. So these austerities actually increase our Krishna consciousness. Like in many places, Prabhupada is actually Prabhupada emphatically points that out, that renunciation which is conducive to Krishna consciousness. Because otherwise these austerities, if it is not done with Krishna consciousness, then it will simply make our hearts hard. Our hearts hard. And hard heart is not good for devotees. Devotees' heart must be soft, because Krishna manifests himself only in the soft heart. Or when Krishna manifests in the heart becomes soft. You see, what is Krishna consciousness? Krishna consciousness is actually love. Now, does love make heart hard? No. Love makes heart like jelly. So jelly makes the heart like butter, soft. Material love makes heart like jelly, but spiritual love makes heart like butter. And when our hearts become like butter, then Krishna will come and steal it.
So,
because automatically then you need teaching more than once you come to the platform rather than having automatically.
There is Radha Yoga Sadhana Bhakti also. There are necessity of teaching. Certain aspects of Radha Yoga Bhakti is taught. Just like as we are discussing now, that this love for Krishna should be spontaneous. Or rather, if the bhakti should be based on our spontaneous, or based on our love for Krishna. That is what Radhanga Bhakti is. Based on love, not rules and regulation. And there is a specific process. The process is that, as I was explaining yesterday, developing an attachment to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was specially keen to give us Radhanga Bhakti, Bhava Bhakti. Krishna came to give us that. And that's why he came, and that's why he became Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So if we approach Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and if we develop our attachment to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we will have it. Actually, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, in a way, he explained what Radhanga Bhakti is. See, when at first Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had a small house in Calcutta where he started to preach, where Prabhupada actually met him in Uttaranga Road in North Calcutta. It was a small house. Did you see it? I haven't. Okay. So then some of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's disciples built a temple, a large temple in Calcutta. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was with the devotees, was taking the deities to that temple. And then he was singing a song that Pujalo Ragopatho Gaurabha Bhanga. Matalo Shatu Jana Vishaya Rakke. The meaning of the song is that Pujalo Ragopatho Gaurabha Bhanga. Gaurab means awe and reverence, opulence. Awe and reverence. The path of awe and reverence has been rejected. And instead, the Ragpat, the spontaneous loving course, has been accepted. And Matalo Sadhu Jana Vishaya Rakke. And therefore the sadhus, the sentient people, have become involved in apparently mundane activities. You understand? That the devotees, the sadhus, general understanding that the sadhus are sadhus don't touch money. The sadhus live in the forest or in the Himalayan caves. The sadhus don't live in cities. Sadhus don't have anything to do with this world, and so on and so forth. But now the sadhus have become involved in apparently mundane activities, vishayarangi. The sadhus are printing books. The sadhus are driving in cars. Sadhus are flying around the world. The sadhus are distributing books. Sadhus are organizing big festivals. So this is not in line with the general concept of sadhus. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is saying that this is the raga. Why the sadhus are doing it? If we ask, why the sadhus are doing this thing?
because of their love for Krishna.
Right.
They don't care about the formalities so much. But their simply concern is what Krishna wants, and they're doing that. So that is what the Rag Bhakti is. Of course, the ultimate consideration of Rag Bhakti is to follow a Ragatmika Bhakta. The Ragatmika Bhaktas are the residents of Vrindavan, Krishna's associates in Vrindavan. So when you spontaneously become attached to one of them, one of Krishna's devotees in Vrindavan, and follow him or her, that is called Rag Anuga Bhakti. So there are different grades, different levels of elevation, but for us, what Srila Prabhupada gave, what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave, that is actually Raghunatha Bhakti. And this is a revolutionary process of spiritual advancement. This is completely revolutionary, because before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, no one could even imagine that. When you reach Chaitanya Chaitanya, you can feel that. Prabhupada Saraswati making fun of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So what kind of sannyasi he is? He's dancing, chanting. Is this the business of a sannyasi? So Mahaprabhu was criticized by all the people because they didn't have the slightest idea what he was giving. Because their whole understanding was so different. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu revolutionized the entire process of spiritual life. Srila Prabhupada also revolutionized it. Actually, Prabhupada did not revolutionize, Prabhupada simply followed what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did and what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave. But that is causing a revolution. Generally, common people don't have the understanding. But this is a very, very special arrangement by the Supreme Personality of Godhead to deliver the most fallen people in the age of Kali. And that is actually the special gift of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Actually, if Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't come, then we would have access to this path. No one would be able to... Like you reach Srimad Bhagavatam, right? When you reach Srimad Bhagavatam, we don't find this kind of activities. Right? When you see, like, we are reading Rishabdev. Rishabdev didn't go and start an organization, a spiritual organization, recruiting people from all over the world. What did Rishabdev do? He just left everything and started walking around like a madman. And that is how the process used to be before. Sukadeva Goswami left home, started to walk around. There was no effort to make a systematic arrangement to preach around the world to deliver the people into the spiritual platform, or rather uplift the people into the spiritual platform. So the bottom line is, like, this International Society for Krishna Consciousness is based on Radhanuga Bhakti. As Mahaprabhu says, calls it the Bhava Bhakti. Guru-disciple relationship is like master and servant relationship. And at the most it can come to some sort of friendship, in a way, but nothing beyond that. But that doesn't come from the disciple's side, that comes from the guru's side. And guru may take the disciple into confidence, but the disciple's position is always like a servant. Or father and son. Okay, thank you all very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Mere Prabhu, would you like to make some? Is there any comment? Hare Krishna. Jai Srila Prabhupada. All glories to the Asambhu Devotee.
And Bhakti Rumaraj ki. Yeah.